Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in the next half hour, we're going to take a look at some white supremacist violence that began 20 years ago this month, as I speak in July of 1999. As I speak in July of 1999, there have been a number of stories in recent months in which people, either individually or in groups of people, have been killed by Nazi and white supremacist elements. This past July 4th, a member of the World Church of the Creator, a Nazi organization, ran amok in the Chicago area, killing a bunch of different people. That also boosted the World Church of the Creator into the national and international eye to a greater extent than it had been before. There was also a widely celebrated case, not celebrated in terms of endorsed, although probably Nazi elements did, in Texas, in which a man was dragged to death behind a car by some white supremacists. In Northern California, there was a case in which a gay couple in Redding were murdered, and a bunch of synagogues were torched in Sacramento. A couple of brothers with white supremacist connections are now under investigation in connection with that as well. All of which is to say this type of activity is escalating dramatically and does not seem to be getting the recognition from the public that it deserves. This is not altogether surprising because an awful lot of things have been allowed to go way out of control. 20 years ago this month, specifically in July of 1979, a series of murders of black children and youths began in Atlanta, Georgia. Ultimately, a black man, Wayne Williams, was convicted of the killings, wrongfully so. The evidence suggests very strongly that Wayne Williams was a patsy. What we're going to do now is to take a look at an article which is in turn an excellent summation of an article which appeared in the September 1986 issue of Spin magazine. This is an article called "Who is the Atlanta Child Murderer?" It was written by Mark D. Turner. It's copyright 1992 and can be accessed on the website www.thuntek.net/Sumeria/politics/Atlanta. And again, this is by Mark D. Turner. The following is excerpted from the One Step Beyond show of July 25th of 1999. Beginning on a Friday night in July of 1979, children started disappearing in Atlanta. Before an arrest would be made in the case, approximately 31 had been mutilated, sexually abused, and murdered. The entire country was wondering, who was the Atlanta child murderer? Today, they only think they know the answer. Wayne Williams. Publicly, the case was handled by the Special Task Force on Missing and Murdered Children. Secretly, there was a high-level secret investigation going on. Each reached very different conclusions, and the correct one was very possibly buried to avert a race war between the blacks and whites in Atlanta. A reliable source contacted the Atlanta police around February of 1981 with information about the string of murders. According to him, 30-year-old Charles Sanders, S-A-N-D-E-R-S, had tried to recruit him into the Ku Klux Klan around 1978 or 1979. Sanders had allegedly told the informant that they were trying to start a race war in Atlanta by killing black children. He wanted help with future murders. At the time, the source thought it was just boasting. By the way, I would note that the aforementioned Operation Thunderbolt, the killing of Nicole and Ron and the framing of O.J. Simpson, as represented in the book Blood Oath by Stephen Wirth and Carl, I've forgotten the other author's name off the top of my head, but in any event, the book Blood Oath is a portrayal of what I believe is very close to the truth concerning what happened with the killing of Nicole and Ron and the framing of O.J. Simpson. And the goal of that Nazi group in Blood Oath was to start a race war. And so I would note that this is not an implausible scenario. Indeed, it's one that white supremacists and Nazis have been trying to enact for quite some time. Returning again to this particular article, who is the Atlanta child murderer? And again, this particular informant basically said that he was recruited, or there was an attempt to recruit him into the Ku Klux Klan around 78 or 9, and that his alleged recruiter, a guy named Charles Sanders, said they were basically said that the Klan was killing black children and was doing that in order to try to start a race war. This particular source, who went to the Atlanta police and was viewed as reliable by the Atlanta police, had more to say. Mark Turner continues, in the summer of 1980,
The informant was with Sanders when Luby Jeter accidentally backed his go-kart into Sanders' car. A few months later, the source was with Sanders again when they saw 14-year-old Jeter. Sanders swore, quote, "I'm going to kill that black bastard. I'm going to strangle him with my D blank blank blank," unquote. On January 3, 1981, Jeter disappeared. He was strangled to death. Dog hairs, probably from a Siberian husky, were found on his body. Sanders owned such a dog. Jeter had last been seen getting into a car with a tall white man with a jagged scar on his neck. Sanders' father, Carlton, has a jagged scar on the left side of his neck. Carlton Sanders had a record of 35 arrests since 1951, including one for molestation, which was later dropped. The secret committee put a tap on Sanders' phone. I would also note that a lot of these kids had been sexually abused as well. Continuing. In March of 1981, another source came forward to say that, quote, "He liked kids and it did not like what the Klan was doing in Atlanta," unquote. Then one of the sources met with Sanders' brother, Jerry, and another Klan member. One of them claimed that after they killed 20 black children, they would start killing black women. On March 2nd, JoJo Bell disappeared. The following evening, a phone call was received at the restaurant he worked at. JoJo told the assistant manager, quote, "This is JoJo. They're about to kill me. I'm about dead. They're about to kill me. Jerry, they're about to kill me," unquote. The phone went dead. I would note that he's saying they, not he, here. Continuing. Late on March 4th, a wiretap recorded a phone call of Charles Sanders, who was working on the sale of M16 rifles and grenades. Now, this is the 30-year-old fellow who basically said he was going to kill Luby Jeter, according to an informant. And Luby Jeter was last seen getting into a car with a white man who fit the description of Charles Sanders' father. Continuing with this wiretap. Sanders, "If you threw that, have to be someone you really wanted to get." Other, "Yeah, I suppose the Klan does S blank 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 like that." Sanders, "Yoo-hoo." And continuing with the main body of text, on March 14th, JoJo Bell's best friend, Tim Hill, disappeared. The next night, another call arrived at the same restaurant. A woman said that her man was dangerous. She said JoJo was different from the other murdered kids because she liked him. She claimed that she was trying to have him released and warned them not to call police or they'd kill him, too. The woman sounded white. JoJo and Hill would both be found dead in rivers later. So note again this other phone call to that very same restaurant that had gotten the call from JoJo Bell, who had worked at that particular restaurant. And this was a woman saying, basically, that indicating that there was a group of people who were killing these particular kids. And according to this account, the woman sounded white. Continuing with this particular story. On April 1st, another phone call was recorded between two of the Sanders brothers. Don, "Is Ricky around?" Terry, "Well, he just left with Kenneth." Don, "Did he?" Terry, "Yeah." Don, "Where's he headed?" Terry, "Well, to his apartment or something." Don, "Do you think he'll be back?" Terry, "Oh, yeah." Don, "After a while?" Terry, "Yep." Don, "I'll just give a buzz back, and I might get out and ride around a little bit, and I might come by there." Terry, "Go find you another little kid?" "Another little kid?" Don, "Yeah, scope out some places. We'll see you later." So note that particular reference. "Go find you another little kid." "Another little kid?" And then the main text of the article, in the main text of the article, Mark Turner continues, "Meanwhile, two Caucasian hairs were found on the underclothes of Charles Stevens, another victim. His body was found in a trailer park which the Sanders brothers visited frequently. The secret investigation then sent agents to gather hair samples from the Sanders dog and from carpet. Nothing seems to have been conclusive about the results, though. But in Atlanta, things had gotten nastier. A confidential source attended several meetings in which blacks were encouraged to arm themselves. There were even plans forming to bring truckloads of weapons into Atlanta. The police department knew things were about to explode. The secret committee met and decided to end their investigation and seal their findings rather than turn them over to the police. If news leaked out of the Klan's possible involvement, they knew a war might start in the streets. Shortly after this, on June 4th, Wayne Williams was supposedly spotted on the Chattahoochee River Bridge. The bodies of two men, aged 21 and 25, were found in or near the river, and Williams was charged with their murders. Rug fibers found on the bodies allegedly matched a rug in Williams' car. No one seemed to care that these victims were young men in their 20s and not children like the others. The case was rushed through the system, and the judge allowed the prosecution to refer to the deaths of 10 Atlanta boys, although Williams was not charged in their cases. Even Vice President George Bush, along with Georgia's governor, pressured the prosecutor to move things fast. The fiber evidence was the main point of the case, which is a rarity. Suddenly, the results of the studies on the hair evidence was changed. It was now said that it might match Williams' German Shepherd as well as a Husky. Ruth Warren changed her description of the man Luby Jeter was last seen with, the white man with the jagged scar. She now fingered Williams. Darryl Davis testified to having seen Jeter and Williams together shortly before the disappearance as well. The prosecution failed to mention that he had earlier said the man with Jeter was 6 feet tall and had a mustache and a goatee. Hardly a portrait of Wayne Williams. Plus, recall, this was not a trial over the murder of Jeter. The trial concerned two murders where there were no witnesses, no recovered weapons, and no fingerprints. But the judge did allow evidence to be shown linking Williams to 29 murders in which the prosecution had even less evidence. Wayne Williams was not told that there were other suspects in the crimes and that there was even greater evidence against them. He was not told about Sanders' comments against Jeter, "I'm going to kill that black bastard," or the Sanders brothers' comments about going out to look for another little boy. He was not told that five of the victims, including Jeter, had known each other, and that Sanders could possibly have known them all, too, since he knew one of them. I remember when Wayne Williams was arrested. There was a relief in the air that a black man was responsible for the deaths. Yes, a series of riots in Atlanta would have been a terrible event, as Los Angeles has proven. But isn't it even more tragic that our basic rights can be taken away so easily? Who's next? You'd be wise to ask. Indeed, I'm going to take just a couple of minutes here to sum up some of the major points of this particular article. And again, I would note that many white supremacist groups have spoken of the intent to start race wars. And according to Stephen Wirth in the book Blood Oath, that's precisely what the cause group, Christian Aryan Underground Special Enforcers, was looking to do with the murder of Nicole and Ron and the framing of O.J. Simpson. Now, note again that someone viewed by the Atlanta, reviewing some of the key points of information here, note again that a reliable source inside of the Atlanta police contacted them in February of 1981 and mentioned that a 30-year-old Klansman, Charles Sanders, had tried to recruit him into the Klan around 78 or 79, and that at the same time he disclosed that the Klan was starting to try to start a race war in Atlanta by killing black children. Then when this same informant was with Sanders and a 14-year-old guy named Luby Jeter backed his go-kart into Sanders' car, Sanders basically said that he was going to kill him and he was going to strangle him with his D blank blank blank, obviously an indication of a desire to sodomize the kid, and note that many of these kids had been sexually abused as well. I would note that when Luby Jeter disappeared and was ultimately found murdered, dog hairs probably from a Siberian Husky were found on his body, and that Sanders owned just such a dog. The last sighting of Jeter had been when he was getting into a car with a tall white man with a jagged scar on his neck, and Sanders' father, Carlton, fits that description, and he had a record of some 35 arrests for molestation, or including one for molestation. Now, another source came forward in March of 1981, basically indicating a very similar scenario, and this source said that he liked kids and did not like what the Klan was doing in Atlanta. Another source met with Sanders' brother, Jerry, and another Klan member, and one of them claimed that after killing 20 black kids, they were going to start killing black women. Another black child disappeared, young JoJo Bell. I shouldn't say child, but a young black fellow, JoJo Bell, disappeared. And that evening, the restaurant that he worked at got a call, basically, in which JoJo said, "This is JoJo, and they're about to kill me. I'm about dead. They're going to kill me." He said they, not he. The phone went dead. And also recall that a wiretap on the phone of Charles Sanders alluded to trafficking in M16 rifles and grenades. And also mentioned that the Klan did stuff like throwing grenades at their opponents. Later, a friend of JoJo, his best friend, in fact, Tim Hill, disappeared. The next night, another call arrived at the very same restaurant, and a woman who appeared to be white or sounded white said that her man was dangerous, said JoJo was different from the other murdered kids because she liked him, and she claimed that she was trying to have him released, that is to say, Tim Hill, and warned them not to call police or they'd kill him, too. And both JoJo and Hill would be found dead in rivers. Also that there was a tapped phone call. Recall that there was a tapped phone call on one of the Sanders brothers in which the following was mentioned. I'll just give a buzz back, and I might go out and ride around a little bit, and I might come by there. Terry, go find you another little kid. Another little kid? Don, yeah, scope out some places. We'll see you later. And recall also the two Caucasian hairs were found on the underclothes of Charles Stephen, yet another victim. His body was found in a trailer park, which the Sanders brothers visited frequently, and a secret investigation team then sent agents to get hair samples from the Sanders dog and carpet. And the political climate in which this was taking place was one in which the possibility of a race war was altogether realistic. Certainly the alarm in the black community in Atlanta was such that they were beginning to arm themselves. I also wondered to what extent, from a psychological standpoint, this was intended as sort of a psy war element against the black community. The killings actually took place in Atlanta when Andrew Young, a former key aide to Martin Luther King, was mayor. And it took place while Jimmy Carter was president of the United States. He, of course, was a native of Georgia and had been governor of Georgia at one point. I wonder whether this was sort of a flipping of the middle finger by these fascist elements in the direction of the black leadership and also of Jimmy Carter, whom they despised. The secret investigating team that was looking in, the secret task force that was looking into the Atlanta child murders, apparently were concerned that if the public perception was an accurate one, that the Klan was killing black kids in order to start a race war, this might lead to race riots in Atlanta. Note that even that longtime friend of African Americans, Vice President George Bush, was pressuring the Atlanta authorities to basically wrap things up very, very quickly and to charge Wayne Williams with the killings. Wayne Williams was found in the vicinity of two men aged 21 and 25, much older than the other victims, and was charged with their murders. And note, too, that there was a sudden change in the studies on the hair evidence. The hairs that were found on Luby Jeter were now said to match Williams' German Shepherd as well as a Husky. Note, too, that a woman named Ruth Warren changed her description of the man Luby Jeter was last seen with, the white man with a jagged scar. She then fingered Wayne Williams. A guy named Darrell Davis testified to having seen Jeter and Williams together shortly after the disappearance as well. But the prosecution did not mention that earlier he had said that the man with Jeter was 6 feet tall and had a mustache and a goatee. And again, that does not fit the description of Wayne Williams. And please note, too, that the trial was originally not over the murder of Luby Jeter. That was a completely extraneous element of evidence under the circumstances. And the trial concerned two murders where there were no witnesses, no recovered weapons, and no fingerprints. And the judge allowed evidence to come into play in this trial that linked Williams to 29 murders in which the prosecution had even less evidence. And note that all of the various evidentiary points that I've touched on were essentially ignored when this crime was covered up. One of the things that I've spoken about in the past, including in an eight half-hour segment series entitled Specialized Knowledge and Abilities, is a plan by fascist elements to infiltrate the military and police, not only to subvert those organizations from within, but to acquire the specialized knowledge and abilities to subvert the democratic state. And one should note that fascist infiltration of the military and of police forces is not something that's particularly new. One of the many reasons that I advocate that people study the assassination of President Kennedy is not only to find out about that pivotal event, but it also, the study of that event serves as a vehicle for viewing much of the underbelly of American society, an underbelly we're going to have to come to know better if we're going to deal successfully with that. We're going to take a look at just one element of that underbelly in a book called Deep Politics and the Death of JFK by the brilliant Berkeley researcher Peter Dale Scott. That book was published in hardcover by the University of California at Berkeley, University of California Press, and copyright 1993. It's an essential book for anyone doing research on the Kennedy assassination. It also, I want to note, does have some serious flaws, but nonetheless, anyone serious about studying that event should certainly own this book. One of the things Peter Dale Scott talks about is the cover-up not only by the Warren Commission but other bodies purportedly investigating Kennedy's assassination of the fact that Jack Ruby was a very prominently connected organized crime figure with numerous connections to the most powerful organized crime figures as well as to people of the so-called overworld of respectable politics. What we're going to look at now is some very soft testimony that was given by a Dallas policeman named Lieutenant George Butler to the Warren Commission, which basically indicated that Jack Ruby was not involved in a bribery attempt directed at Dallas law enforcement by a Ruby organized crime associate named named Paul Roland Jones. This as part of an apparently deliberate attempt to see to it that the pieces were not put together by tracing with regard to Jack Ruby or the entire Kennedy assassination conspiracy. Turning now to Deep Politics and the Death of JFK by Peter Dale Scott. In 1964, the same yay-saying Lieutenant Butler told the FBI in an interview accepted perhaps too easily by the Warren Commission and the House Committee that Jack Ruby, quote, was not involved in the bribery attempt, unquote, by Jones. Just one of a series of attempts, very successful too, by the way, by numerous people familiar with Ruby's extensive organized crime connections and some of his political connections to downplay those connections. And I would note too that Lieutenant George Butler was in the basement of the Dallas police headquarters when Ruby shot Oswald, and he was conspicuously agitated when that event took place. Returning again to Deep Politics and the Death of JFK by Peter Dale Scott. Butler was also in the Dallas police basement when Ruby shot Oswald, and one journalist was struck that this normally phlegmatic man was so, quote, extremely nervous, unquote, just before the shooting that his lips were trembling. And I would note also that not only was Lieutenant George Butler downplaying Jack Ruby's organized crime connections for the Warren Commission, he was not only present in the Dallas police basement when Ruby shot Oswald and behaving in very uncharacteristically nervous fashion, but Lieutenant George Butler was also a former head of the Dallas Policemen's Union, a key anti-communist activist in the Dallas area. He also was a recruiter and organizer for the Ku Klux Klan and had some very interesting testimony about the Dallas police force. Turning once again to Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, according to an organizer for the Ku Klux Klan in 1961, quote, half the police force in Dallas were members of the KKK, unquote. This organizer, a former head of the Dallas Policemen's Union and speaker for anti-communist causes, was someone we have already encountered, Lieutenant George E. Butler. So note, according to George Butler, half of the Dallas police force were members of the KKK. Even if one assumes that that's puffery, let's assume he was doubling the actual number, even a quarter of the Dallas police force being KKK would be an extremely alarming number. And sometimes white supremacists and Nazi elements downplay their actual influence within police departments. Recruitment within the LAPD appears to have been one of the things that fostered the killing of Nicole and Ron and the framing of O.J. Simpson. And I think that people sincerely concerned about maintaining order and democracy in the United States should be taking the tactic of specialized knowledge and abilities as advocated by German Nazi lawyer and organizer and theoretician Jürgen Rieger very, very seriously indeed. One wonders to what extent Klan infiltration of urban police departments has furthered the, such activities as the Atlanta child murders as well. I would note, too, that as with the assassination of John F. Kennedy, the Atlanta child murders, of a very important event and an event that was much broader than it was portrayed as being, both were the results of fascist violence, and both were attributed to lone nuts. Indeed, there are a lot of Nazi activities that have been coming to light and a lot of crimes perpetrated by Nazi elements. However, when these elements are properly identified, they're always called lone nuts. Yeah, lone nut party number, 1,332,212. They're not lone nuts. They're fascists and Nazis and should be identified as such. The various tapes that I produced over the years are available from a tape duplication called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They can be located at P.O. Box 1179. That's P.O. Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. Email address, spitfire@ix.nepcom.com. That's spitfire@ix.nepcom.com. There's a list of and description of the various programs available on the Spitfire website. Some of those descriptions, many of them actually very long and sort of constituting mini articles in and of themselves. They can be found on the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. That's www.spitfirelist.com. Spitfire List is one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E-L-I-S-T. And you can also find that information on the KFJC website at www.kfjc.org. Look in the Transmissions and News and Public Affairs section. Once again, www.kfjc.org. Look in News and Public Affairs. The Spitfire website is also equipped with real audio, and people can listen to the segments going out to the various stations that carry the program on any given week and read along with the descriptions. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.